Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. From the Kennedy Center to the Smithsonian, the second Trump administration is exerting its influence on venerated cultural institutions. Earlier this year, President Trump signed an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. He has also assigned an attorney from his legal team to help remove improper ideology from the Smithsonian museums. But what is improper ideology, and who is the attorney tasked with enforcing these changes? Joining us now to help answer these questions is Washington Post features reporter Maura Judkis. Welcome to All Sides, Maura.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with improper ideology. How is that defined?
Well, it has a very flexible definition, I would say. It's kind of vague enough that it's anything the White House might need it to be as they seek to push the Smithsonian to align with its priorities. But when I interviewed Lindsay Halligan, who is one of the authors of this executive order, her definition is that improper ideology would be weaponizing history, she said. She added, we don't need to overemphasize the negative to teach people that certain aspects of our nation's history may have been bad, because that overemphasis makes us grow further and further apart.
Okay, so that's her definition of improper ideology. Did you hear other definitions, or is that basically what we're going with because it's the Trump administration that's trying to define it?
Well, so in the executive order, they kind of elaborate a little bit that it's about our nation's unparalleled legacy of advancing liberty and individual rights, rather than defining the country as something inherently racist or sexist or oppressive. And so I would say that in its application, improper ideology seems to be anything in a museum that has to do with racism or immigration or the LGBT community mostly.
So tell us a little bit more about the name you said, Lindsay Halligan. So she's the member of President Trump's legal team who will be enforcing any changes that happen with Smithsonian museums related to improper ideology. And her name is in the executive order. So who is Lindsay Halligan?
Yes. So Lindsay Halligan her title used to be assistant to the president for domestic policy. She has now moved into another role where she is the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. However, as far as this executive order goes, she claims to be sort of the author of it, essentially, in that she came to work for the president. She was formerly a member of his legal team who worked on the Mar-a-Lago document raid and some other things for him. She got this new role. She came to Washington. She went to some museums for fun, basically, just to see what they were like, because she was going to be living in Washington now, and saw some things that she didn't like. And so she says that she then took that to the president and suggested this executive order, and that's where it essentially came from. However, I should say that other organizations like the Heritage Foundation have targeted the Smithsonian before this. One of the Project 2025 authors wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal last year that cited the Smithsonian as a major source of, quote, wokeness in D.C. So the idea had been existing in Trump world before her. It seems like she was one of the people who was able to execute it and turn it into this executive order.
Okay. So aside from being an attorney, so you mentioned that she worked on the Mar-a-Lago documents case, but does she have any background in museum work, or has she done anything with history, or is she simply an attorney?
She has not done much with history. She claims to have an interest in history. That's what she told me when I interviewed her. But she, she was an insurance attorney in South Florida before she happened to meet the president on a golf course, which is when he asked her to join his legal team. She doesn't have a background in museums or art history. She said she studied history as an undergrad, but that seems to be the extent of it, or at least from what she's presented to us.
And so you mentioned that you did speak with her, you interviewed her. Did she tell you anything about what at the Smithsonian that she saw that she felt did not reflect the America that she knows and loves? Was there anything in particular, or was it just kind of a sweeping thing?
Yeah, there are several exhibitions that she has cited, both in that interview and then also in memorandum that have come ever since then, too. One big show that has seemed to really capture the administration's attention is an exhibition called The Shape of Power that was at the American Art Museum. And it explores the way that different races of people sculpt themselves and others. And in part of the wall text for that exhibition, it explains that race is not biological, and that sculpture has been a powerful tool in promoting scientific racism, in that it could be used to perpetuate harmful stereotypes about bodies of people of color. This was cited in several memorandum about the Smithsonian. There have also been a few specific works of art that they have cited as being improper ideology. Some of those are paintings of immigrants crossing the border. One of them is Amy Sherald's painting called Transforming Liberty, which is a portrait of a trans woman posing as the Statue of Liberty. And the artist Amy Sherald actually canceled her upcoming show in fear of censorship frustration and from the Smithsonian. But to give you an example of how malleable this definition of ideology is, another work that was called out was a portrait of Anthony Fauci, which doesn't fit under any of those other, examples that they've cited, but is someone that, you know, that the president has has not been a fan of. So it can kind of be anything they want it to be, seemingly. That all came under a memo that the White House released called "The President, President Trump was right about the Smithsonian."
Yeah, the Fauci painting, they're saying is improper ideology because we shouldn't be. He shouldn't be like immortalized in a painting and be displayed at the Smithsonian. Is that what they mean? Or like, did he just object to it existing?
Essentially, they're calling out anything that's partisan, but partisan on a Democrat side, or things that they view to be partisan, I should say, because the director of the National Portrait Gallery, Kim Syatt, she was, I want to put this in quotation marks, fired by the president, in a Truth Social posting, although he doesn't actually have the authority to fire directors of museums, because the Smithsonian is not under the executive branch. It's a public trust. And so only the secretary of the Smithsonian has that authority. It became this kind of highly publicized standoff in the spring because she refused to accept the firing. The reason for his quote unquote firing for her was that she was highly partisan and that she was a supporter of DEI. Eventually, she ended up resigning because she didn't want the museum to have to continue to suffer the bad publicity, and she wanted the employees to be able to move forward, or at least that's what she's expressed during interviews. So it's become, partisanship in the museum world has become a subject that the Trump administration is keeping a very close watch on.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Trump administration's commissioner to remove improper ideology from Smithsonian museums with Washington Post features reporter Maura Judkiss. So the examples that you gave, that sculpture exhibit, the Fauci portrait, like, did they stay in the Smithsonian or did they get taken down?
Well, with the exception of the Amy Sherald show, which the artist herself decided to pull out of, nothing has been taken down yet, at least to our knowledge. There is a review, a widespread review that Lindsay Halligan and other members of the administration have called for. That is something that the Smithsonian is cooperating with. And so we will see what the results of that review are. There have been a few things that we've noticed that have changed. The way that The American History Museum referred to Trump's impeachment. Some of that messaging had changed and then was later replaced when our reporting called it out. But other than that, in terms of art, I think everyone in the museum world is still waiting to see what happens. There have been some shows that have been postponed at different museums, but when we've asked the museums about that, they've cited things like funding rather than the administration. However, some of those exhibitions that were postponed may have been things that the administration might not have liked. And so it's really hard to say, how much of this is internal pressure, external pressure. A really tough funding environment for sure is also part of this. I think that it will affect the content of exhibitions to come as this review takes place. We'll see how much they are able to edit out.
So in the introduction earlier, I mentioned that President Trump signed an executive order, and it was titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. So can an executive order, I mean, I don't know exactly what teeth an executive order in this case would have. Like, so he can just say in this executive order, this is what he wants, and the order assigns Lindsey Halligan to look into it. What else is in the order?
Right. Well, so the first thing about the order that you kind of touch on there that's interesting is that the Smithsonian is a trust instrumentality of the U.S. It gets a lot of funding from Congress. It has members of Congress who sit on the Board of Regents, but it's not an executive branch agency. And so, the president's ability to directly change the content of exhibitions is limited. However, in this executive order, there is sort of this under, un, I would say, like, I can't call it a threat exactly, but there's kind of an understated ability to, maybe withhold funding from museums that don't comply. And so that is the mechanism for perhaps getting these museums to align with the ideology that the White House has put forth. It also the executive order also addresses a couple of other museums that have not even yet opened, like the Museum of the American Latino and a Museum of Women's History. Those museums are still fundraising; they are still seeking to open, and so it makes you wonder whether those museums will actually come to fruition, depending on how this review turns out.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's funding for the Smithsonian's. I can't, is it like 60% comes from Congress for like basic operations, staff, and that kind of thing? And then whenever there's special exhibits, that's normally privately funded. Is that my correct
Correct.
understanding? Okay.
Yes.
So, I mean, I guess the president could lean on Congress to impact the Smithsonian funding, right?
Correct, correct. And also, the Board of Regents, as the terms of the current regents expire, I would not be surprised if the White House seeks to install regents that are aligned with the Trump White House, who are Trump insiders. That would also have an impact.
This executive order that I mentioned, the Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, was signed at the end of March. Prior to that, maybe in January or early February, there was another executive order related to teaching patriotism in schools. But it kind of all ties together with the way we teach history. You did interview for your article. You spoke with the Organization of American Historians. What has their reaction been to all of this?
Many people in the history and museum worlds are pretty chilled and a little bit horrified by this. They know that it will potentially impact the way that they are able to organize exhibitions. They also are concerned about funding for exhibitions too. It's definitely had a big impact on people who work in these spaces and who are curating these types of shows that address the issues that the White House has deemed improper.
And as we mentioned, Lindsey Halligan, has she actually done anything yet related to the executive order and her role? Because this order came out at the end of March, so it's been a few months. I have has she herself taken any action? Or you said it, she's reviewing. Is that right?
Yeah, so right now this review is taking place. The actions I would say that she has done are releasing these memos that have called out specific artworks. I mean, that has definitely had an impact, especially in that the Amy Sherald show was canceled. That was supposed to be the big fall show here. And so the cancellation of that show was probably the biggest impact so far. I mean, Lindsay Halligan was not the person who fired Kim Sayat. That was the president who tweeted that. However, it's all kind of part of the same effort to, curtail what museums are saying about race and gender and immigration. And so the Amy Sherald, unfortunately, that will not be taking place. It moved to Baltimore.
Yeah, and just to end on, the executive order singles out, you mentioned the African American Museum, the American Women's History Museum, which isn't open yet, the American Art Museum. But I mean, the Smithsonian has lots of museums in its portfolio. I noted there's no the Air and Space Museum's not singled out, or there's a museum with like of postage stamps. The Smithsonian does a lot of things. Are they focusing in basically on race and sexism in this?
Here's so, yeah, because the museums, the postage museum has not been called out. The Air and Space Museum, I don't believe was in any of those memos. But yeah, the museums that they seem to have focused on the most are the Portrait Gallery, the American Art Museum, the National Museum of African American History and Culture. In a more recent memo, the National Museum of the American Indian was called out as well. The Natural History Museum too, because it teaches about race as well.
I've been to the Postage Stamp Museum. It's adorable, by the way. So, all
It's a great
right.
one. It's
Yeah.
underrated.
Yeah, it is. It's very underrated, and it wasn't very crowded. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, and I guess maybe we'll speak again once it goes past the review stage and becomes more than memos. So, we've been speaking with Maura Judkiss, features reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how museums and schools can accurately teach American history. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurovich. More than 1,000 U.S. museums are accredited by the American Alliance of Museums. Many feature permanent and traveling exhibits documenting the nation's history. We're talking about how museums and schools can accurately teach American history in the face of challenges to remove information the Trump administration feels teaches improper ideology. Joining us now is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He is a College of Arts and Sciences Alumni Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University, where he teaches courses in civil rights and the Black Power movement. Professor Jeffries is also on the National Board of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and he's the board chair of President James Madison's Mount Pilgrim. Welcome to All Sides.
Great to be with you, Amy.
And we're also bringing into this conversation Rebecca Bollier, president and CEO of the Taft Museum of Art in Cincinnati and a board member of the American Alliance of Museums. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca, let's start with you. As a board member of the American Alliance of Museums, what do you think when you heard about that March executive order to remove improper ideology from museums, specifically the Smithsonian's? What did that make you think?
Well, obviously, as mission-driven educational institutions, we see museums as providing unbiased, inclusive, and problematized history. We look at history through all lenses, and whether you are in an art museum, a science museum, or a history museum, the idea is to provide knowledge to encourage thought, reflection, and in some ways, maybe facing some uncomfortable truths. So for us, when we saw that, not only I think was there a concern for the many member museums of the AAM that may be impacted, but also the idea that it's a relatively unclear guideline. And when we look at history, we try to avoid something where we are giving ourselves guidelines that are very hard to follow. We like clarity, and that was pretty unclear direction.
Aside from this executive order, have museums been facing pressures to modify, remove, or limit exhibits? Like, you know, maybe you're not, maybe the executive order is impacting museums in your organization, but they're hearing from like average people who go and visit and object to something.
It's absolutely something that we deal with regularly in museums. And frankly, we appreciate those opportunities as moments to provide additional education. So, for instance, if we're telling a story that includes an element that someone finds inappropriate or may find just out of line with the experience that they were hoping to have, we try to explain why we do that. So many museums will typically have things like a frequently asked questions list that they put out at their front desk just to provide some guidance for these questions. So this is something that we deal with regularly, that we always have before and after this administration. We always will do this. But for us, we typically welcome these moments to educate and to provide context. So this is nothing new, but I would say there's definitely a finer point on it right now.
When you think specifically of this executive order, do you think is it does it feel like just a Washington, D.C. thing? Or after the review is done in the Smithsonian's, will other museums around the country be impacted?
Yes, this is absolutely something that is impacting virtually every single museum in this country. This is not something that we see as limited to, you know, inside the Beltway. This is something that we look at as more than a political issue. This impacts our livelihoods. It impacts the reasons that we choose to go into the museum world, why we elect to work in nonprofit educational institutions. We're there because we share a passion and a drive for the mission and the message. And if the mission and the message is being analyzed, scrutinized, and potentially changed because of federal guidelines, that puts us in a very precarious position. And I think any 21st century museum professional would say that it is something that keeps them up at night. The executive order and all associated domino effects that may come thereafter.
Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries, let's bring you into the conversation now. You have the unique perspective of serving on museum boards and teaching history. What do you think of this term being used, improper ideology?
Well, it's a made-up term. It's a political term. And as was mentioned at the top of the hour, it's designed to be sort of all-encompassing. I mean, anything that disturbs, upsets, not just the president, but those who have sort of those who have surrounded him with and who have a particular bias against teaching these various subjects that they don't want to be taught in an honest way, whether we're talking about racism or sexism and the like. I mean, just teaching American history in a truthful and honest way. And this is, you know, we talked about sort of, you know, the executive order and the domino sort of effect of what follows. But the executive order and, you know, was a domino itself, because the assault on teaching history, on museums, on historic sites, talking about this history honestly is not new. We saw a resurgence of sort of we have to get rid of wokeism, if you will, whatever that nonsense, you know, phrase is, another of these nonsense phrase, all encompassing, following the 2020 protests and the calls for the removal of various Confederate statues and monuments. Those historic sites, and Montpelier was one of them, gets labeled as one of these that are engaged in this sort of falsifying of history. So this is an extension, a ramping up of what we have seen in recent times.
And the lawyer who is tasked with removing the improper ideology, Lindsay Halligan, she's in the executive order, she says that it's weaponizing history. She says that the overemphasis on the negative is what's making our country grow further apart. So what do you think about that?
What were her qualifications again for this particular position?
She's a lawyer.
A lawyer, an insurance lawyer who bumped into Donald Trump during a golf tournament. Right?
I wasn't there.
So. I wasn't there either, but we've done the research. And hopefully now that she's moved on to bigger and better things, serving in the, you know, sort of Eastern District, that some sanity will be returned to, you know, sort of the critiques and reviews of these institutes. I mean, basically, you're talking about putting in people who are serving a political political will and whim of those who don't want this history done. So I really honestly cannot take what she says seriously. But the actions that she takes and others in her wake, we do have to take seriously because those have real world effects. And they impact not only what museums can do, but what people learn.
Rebecca, have you heard from museums in the Alliance? Have they been increasingly experiencing problems with financial support in the wake of this executive order? Are people afraid to donate money to the museum or sponsor an exhibit because they don't want negative attention, I guess?
Sure. So, well, it's kind of twofold, the response, right? The first is that many of our federal grant programs were suspended indefinitely, meaning that dollars that had already been awarded to fund museum programs, but had not yet been received, were never sent. So this has been an absolutely catastrophic financial situation for many of our museum peers. So there's the immediate fallout of the loss of funds for this current budget year. But then when we look at the future, I think that there is this idea of how much should we be self-censoring so that we are not welcoming negative inquiry, or the idea that we could lose funding from either individuals or structured giving opportunities like grants and sponsorships. At the same time, I will say that this is not something that feels fatalistic for museums, but rather we look at ourselves as, you know, beacons of light and education in the United States. And we are very proud of the work that we do. We are seeing that if we have to change our financial models, well, we will. We've dealt with COVID. We've dealt with changes in tax codes. We have dealt with things that have been inopportune or a turnoff for donors. So if there is something that we need to do to change, there is nothing more resilient than a small museum worker in this country.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how museums and schools can accurately teach American history while avoiding improper ideology, with Hessam Kwame Jeffries, an associate professor of history at Ohio State University, and Rebecca Bollier, president and CEO of the Taft Museum of Art in Cincinnati, and a board member of the American Alliance of Museums. Professor Jeffries, in an interview with the New York Times, a civil rights attorney and the founder of the Equal Justice Institute, Brian Stevenson, he says that cultural institutions should expand their efforts, not retreat. What does that mean to you?
That means that Brian Stevenson and the work that he's doing with Equal Justice Initiative, and anybody who gets a chance to visit Montgomery, Alabama, and the complex of museums and historic sites and sculpture gardens dedicated to exploring American history and the history of slavery and mass incarceration, the way it actually occurred and its impact, he's saying that we're doing the right thing. We have been doing the right thing. We're the ones who have been leaning into truth and honesty with a real a commitment to understanding not just the parts of America's past that make us feel comfortable, but the parts of America's past that make us feel uncomfortable, the real difficult aspects of history. He's like, don't shy away from that. Now is the time, perhaps more than any other time in recent American history, where we have to point out and highlight those aspects of the past that still influence the present that were not sort of part of the nostalgic telling of American history. So if we're going to listen to somebody, let's listen to Brian Stevenson and not the insurance attorney.
Rebecca, same question to you. What do you make of him saying that cultural institutions should expand their efforts, not retreat?
I could not agree more. I think this is absolutely what museums should be doing. To echo my co-panelist here, what we're really looking at is democracy in action. This is who we are as Americans. We are thought to think critically, to think proactively, not just reactively. We are here to look and to understand. And we learn more from the moments of discomfort than those of comfort. We're not going to learn if we are always just looking at the things that we enjoy or find pleasant. In fact, this is a moment that others may look back on and say, well, I wonder who was ringing the alarm bell. And for a lot of us in our communities, those are our local museums. Those are the ones that are going to be telling the stories that resonate.
You're the CEO of the Taft Museum of Art, in addition to being on the board we've been talking about. So, as the CEO of the Taft Museum of Art, if a traveling exhibit was deemed controversial and it was offered to you because it was pulled out of somewhere else and you had the funding for it, would you want the exhibit or would you hesitate?
Well, I think that what I would look at are the same qualities that we always look at. The federal government would not play a role in that conversation. The conversation is about how does this relate to our mission? How does this relate to our strengths as an institution? And how does this relate to our larger community of museum goers and the Cincinnati community? So those are our top priorities. And I don't think that any entity, even our federal government, can wedge their way into having a seat at that table.
Well, and federal government aside, I mean, your museum is in blue Cincinnati, but in a very red state. Have you ever heard anything from the state government related to the running of your museum recently?
We have not heard anything from the state government. I'm pleased to say that in Ohio, we actually have a lot, though everyone's on a variety of stops on the political spectrum. We have a lot of support for our cultural institutions. So I have found that that has continued. As you said, Cincinnati is a Democratic stronghold, unusually in Ohio. So we do have a lot of support from the local government. But I would say when we talk to our legislators, our elected officials at the state level, when we go through Museum Advocacy Day, which is our day on the Hill for museum professionals every spring, we unilaterally get support from our officials. Now, how that is in practice, we may have differing views on, but I would say that this is not something where people are looking to cause issues at the moment for their institutions. At this point, everyone's playing nice in Ohio, and I can be on board with that.
Professor Jeffries, have other presidents throughout history asserted any influence over museums, or like have presidents ever said before what, to stop exhibiting something?
Well, you've had presidents, you've had the executive branch sort of share thoughts and ideas. But I think what is unique about this particular moment is the extent to which this current president, this administration, is leveraging federal dollars to withhold to or withholding federal dollars, leveraging federal money, resources to influence, to impact. That's different. It's one thing to say, hey, I think this should go in the portrait gallery, or I wasn't a big fan of, of this exhibition or something like that. It's another thing to say, unless you change this, you will not receive these federal dollars. Which, with Congress and the House of Representatives, yielding, surrendering that power, I think that's what's most different. People have always had opinions, but to exert this kind of force of arms, if you will, onto sort of cultural institutions, that is unique to this moment.
And Rebecca, what about you? Have you heard from, I mean, I don't know how long you've been in the museum business, but have other administrations ever leaned on any of the museums in the American Alliance of Museums before to say, I don't like that?
Yeah, so I've been in the museum field for about 25 years, but even predating that, there have been some infamous questions about censorship and issues with certain content that has been in the museum world. So we look at the 1980s in particular, when the moral majority had a very strong presence, and the idea of contemporary art that was seen as, let's put it maybe in their terms, unsavory, was something that came under attack, especially for those organizations that were funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. So this is something that has happened in more conservative administrations in the past. At the same time, it's absolutely true that the expedited removal of funds from institutions and the threat of future defunding is something that we have not experienced in the past. So this methodology of moving through executive orders is something that's relatively new, and also speaks to, in some ways, the value of museums, that one of the first things to attempt to dismantle in this administration is our spirit of cultural inquiry, thought, and collective action, which we see in museums. So this is telling, support your museums, people, because we need you as much as we ever have.
Our guest has been Rebecca Bollier, the president and CEO of the Taft Museum of Art in Cincinnati and a board member of the American Alliance of Museums. Thank you for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, Professor Jeffries is staying with us, and we're going to continue talking about teaching history in both museums and in schools. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. American history is complex. It has its triumphs, including winning a war for independence and lots of innovations in industry. However, it also has its hard truths of slavery, mistreatment of Native Americans, as well as the internment camps of Japanese Americans during World War II. These hard truths can be viewed as improper ideology the Trump administration is seeking to have removed from museums and schools. We're talking this hour about how museums and schools can accurately teach American history going forward. Still with us is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's a College of Arts and Sciences Alumni Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University. He teaches courses in civil rights and the Black Power movement. Professor Jeffries is also on the National Board of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History and is the board chair of President James Madison's Mount Pelier. So thanks for being here again, Professor Jeffries.
Of course,
As a scholar, what do you make of this moment in America where the White House is basically encroaching on cultural institutions? I mean, the Kennedy Center, the Smithsonian. What is this moment in American history to you?
Well, I think we can't look at the actions of this administration in isolation. So as we've just been discussing, as you illustrated and pointed out, they're going after cultural institutions and what they do not want to have appear within these cultural institutions, what narratives of American history they don't want to be highlighted. But we have to also connect that to the assault on higher education, and particularly on freedom of speech and what can be taught in schools and what programs should be supported. This is part of the anti-diversity and equity and initiative programs. But then we also have to connect that to the assault on media. We're sitting here in this beautiful WOSU NPR station, and we look at the funding that was cut. And that wasn't an accident. I mean, that's been part of this effort to sort of silence those who, again, are offering a truthful analysis of America's past and present. So those three are absolutely all connected. You get rid of the cultural, because the cultural is often our cultural institutions are often sort of leading critics, offering these sort of alternative views of how we should understand America in this moment in America's past. Universities are giving that deep critical thinking, and then, you know, public media offering a fair and balanced approach to America in the contemporary moment. So those three are absolutely connected. And I think that's why, you know, sources of criticism, legitimate criticism of the administration, that's why they've all been targeted simultaneously.
There are many businesses, from technology to certain parts of academia to certain parts of the media, who have capitulated to demands from the Trump administration. They're basically finding it easier to go along to get along, right? Does that concern you when it comes to museums and how history is taught, too?
No, it absolutely does concern me, because and I understand the legitimate, you know, fears in terms of financing and funding. But it's concerning because our museums and our classrooms is where we get sort of that the real truth about what America is, what America was, and what America can be. And when we begin to censor and self-censor, then the possibilities for what America can be get really narrowed. What this democracy can look like and what it should look like get narrowed. And that's a real fear. And we know what that looks like. I mean, you know, when, you know, you enter into sort of authoritarian regimes and these institutions and leaders of these institutions, you know, sort of capitulate voluntarily to avoid being in the limelight or in the crosshairs, it doesn't really save you. So now is the time, I think, as Brian Stevenson was saying, to double down, to say no, and to not do it in isolation, right? I mean, museums, you know, the American Alliance, and and other organizations, history organizations, the Organization for American Historians, are calling for people to come together and stand together, because that is that united voice saying, nope, we're not going to do this, will be critically important in terms of pushing back.
One of the biggest points of contention with all of this improper ideology is the teaching of slavery. You are the board chair of President James Madison's Mount Pelier, and it's a historic plantation home of the Madisons. Have you talked about improper ideology and the teaching of slavery with your board? I mean, you're the board chair.
Yeah. No. I mean, and not in the sense that we're well aware of the consequences. Because we've been in the crosshairs for not just, you know, 6 months. You know, we've been in for half a decade ever since the board at Montpelier made the decisive decision to open up leadership to descendants of enslaved people from Montpelier, right? So half of the board seats are nominated by the members of the descendant community. That was, you know, a revolutionary step. I mean, this is, you know, the only presidential estate that has done that, has embraced this kind of equity in leadership decision making. So
when did you do that?
We did that on the heels, that was sort of the end of 2020.
Okay.
And into 2021. And we've been catching heck for it ever since. You know, we became too woke and all this other nonsense. But we didn't look back, because that was the right thing to do. James Madison, fourth president of the United States, claimed ownership over 100 people of African descent. Never freed a single soul. It's his plantation estate, but it was also a slave labor camp. You cannot tell the full story of somebody like Madison or Jefferson or Washington or Mount Vernon without telling the story of the community in which he lived. He lived in a black community, right? There's only 5 white people living around there. So, no, there's no turning back, because to do so would be to not tell the truth of what happened. You know, this isn't Disney World. It is hard history, and it's complicated. And it's our job as stewards of historic sites to make sure that people receive this critical truth so that they can better understand what happened.
Does James Madison's historic site get federal funding?
Through various grants. And so this is where sort of the cutting off of federal funding impacts historic sites and museums in different ways. So there are federal grants that we apply to. But there's also grants that we apply through Virginia Humanities that receives funding from the National Endowment for Humanities. So when you cut that off, a lot of local historic sites and museums lost funding, not directly, but indirectly, because their funding was coming through humanities sites.
I heard an interview with a member of the Heritage Foundation who was talking about the teaching of slavery. And he basically said that he doesn't want the teaching of slavery to stop. He wants it to be taught, but he wants it to be taught in the context of slavery. I think I'm not quoting him directly, but it's something like slavery has been used for thousands of years in every country all around the world. And America gets most vilified for it.
Yeah, I mean that's you know one of the ways, and it's an old sort of spin and narrative on you know sort of American exceptionalism. Like you know slavery, yes, slavery is bad, but slavery wasn't that significant in America. Nobody's saying who is actually dealing with either teaching or exploring slavery through an exhibition that America somehow started the institution of slavery. No, but America chose to buy into it. America chose to build this nation on an economic foundation of the institution of slavery. And we can't go back and rewrite that history. I mean, you have those who are running around now saying, you know, this is why it's so critically important to understand this history. You have those who are running around talking about the founders and the framers of the U.S. Constitution were coming up on a 250th anniversary, saying that they were actually abolitionists and that the Constitution is actually an abolitionist document. I was like, well, look, if they're abolitionists, they were the worst abolitionists that ever existed because it takes almost a century to abolish slavery. And you can't have that fundamental rewriting of the past because that does impact the present. If you're saying that these founders, right, like slavery existed, but everybody had it, that's just rational. Rationalizing evil. They knew it was wrong, and yet they put in these protections to support it so that it would continue to flourish and thrive here in America, and they embed protections in the Constitution. And we're debating the Constitution right now, and we have to understand the context out of which that comes out of.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how museums and schools can accurately teach history while avoiding improper ideology with Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries, a history professor at Ohio State University. There was an executive order back in January related to the emphasis on patriotic education in schools as opposed to what's being called like woke education in schools. Do you know of any history teachers who have made changes to history curriculum?
What you have found, I think, and this is not just from, we can't lay this all on the feet of the Trump administration. I mean, we're sitting here in Ohio, and Ohio passed several years ago its anti-divisive topics bill. We just did another version of that, if you will, within that applied to higher education institutions with SB1. And so this is an extension of what we've seen here in Ohio for the last couple of years. And when you look at the letter of the law, this is why these are all nonsense bills, because nobody's teaching what they're being told not to teach, right? You know, nobody's running around and teaching that white people are inherently evil, but we are teaching that slavery in America was race-based. But the effect of it is that teachers are afraid, K through 12 and colleagues, right? Well, what happens if I get a parent, or not even a parent, just some individual who decides, who hears something I say and takes it out of context? You know, what happens to my job? What happens to my life? What happens to my livelihood? And so it's not so much that teachers are suddenly not teaching or teaching a different version of America's past. What we're seeing is more omission, dancing around. It's like, well, I think I'll just leave this aspect and move quickly beyond it.
Or they'll say, go ask your parents.
Or go ask your parents. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, and we cannot have that. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that is frankly educational malpractice. Mm-hmm. And I understand, you know, the worries and concerns in this new SB1 bill that was passed. I mean, anybody can file a complaint against a faculty member at a public university, not just a student, if they just hear something and the university has to investigate. What the heck is that, right? I mean, that is going to have a chilling effect. It has had a chilling effect, but it's important that all of us who have a little bit of space to say, no, you know, in this classroom, we're going to deal with the truth. We're going to deal with hard history. We're going to deal with difficult subjects, and we're going to deal with it truthfully and honestly.
Do you have students in your classes at Ohio State who have been taught an oversimplified version of American history? Like, whenever you teach them something, do you have students who have never heard it before?
Oh, every year. Darn near every student at Ohio State. I mean, look, because they're coming through the same educational system, right? And this is what we have to, you know, this is sort of our charge. And what happens, right? I mean, they walk into the classroom from teaching civil rights or American history, African-American history, and we start talking about basic facts of American history, right? Like Thomas Jefferson was an enslaver. never freed anybody except, you know, he's the Epstein of his time, right? Like, oh my God, kids, you know, like they wind up going through the five stages of grief, right? It's disbelief, it's anger. I mean, literally.
Because they're like, I dressed up as Thomas Jefferson for Halloween.
That was my guy, right? Yeah. Like, what's going on, right? But in the end, you know, that fifth stage of grief is acceptance. And that's what we want as educators. That's our task and our mission, to get students to accept historical reality, history the way it happened. Now, what they choose to do with that after, that's up to them. But we have to get them from that denial and anger to acceptance. That's all we're trying to do.
We have about a minute left, but do you feel like any textbooks are going to end up changing? Can the Trump administration influence that in the what textbooks go into K-12 schools versus at colleges and universities?
You know, textbooks are so last century, right?
Yeah.
And so it's less going to be the physical textbook in this day and age. And more, as we're seeing increasingly in AHA, did American Historical Association, did a wonderful study on what are teachers actually using. And what we'll see, and we've seen this already, it's not so much textbooks, but it's the sort of, YouTube videos, right? The pseudo universities, right? Prager University videos. Florida, for example, now is leaning on and requiring their teachers to sort of use those and having professional development around these sort of, you know, alt-right, hard-right, patriotic history videos. So that's what we're seeing. And that content is terrible. Because it is not the version of American history that happened. It's America's never bad. America's always been exceptional, and this other stuff. That's where I think we're seeing that the educational resource direction headed, and that's deeply troubling.
Our guest has been our guest this hour on All Sides has been Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History here at Ohio State University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Amy.
And you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.